First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
If you've got City Hall connections, you're getting paid in federal COVID relief money, that is. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, a WJCT News investigation, a look at the flawed process the city is using to dole out millions in COVID relief funds. What are your questions? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, our book club celebrates the written word. We'll also speak with local author Jane Condon and look ahead to this weekend's Jax by Jax Literary Arts Festival. All of that ahead, but first this hour, outrage has grown around town as we learn more about the process to award COVID grant relief money in the city. Dozens of nonprofit groups, many with connections to City Hall, are in line for another $4.6 million in federal COVID relief money that the City Council could allocate tonight with only limited oversight. Now, the list of organizations includes several whose leaders donated to City Council members' campaigns, some with friends or relatives of council members, some who have worked with council members in the past. WJCT News has done a very deep dive into how all of these connections fall together and where the money could go. Reporters Claire Heddles and Ramon Troncoso have been digging into the numbers, and they both join us here now in studio for a closer look. Good morning to you both.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
Hey, Melissa.
549-2937 as we talk about this WJCT News investigation. Claire Heddles, let's begin with you. This controversy has been brewing for a couple of weeks now, but it's gotten sharper as we learn more about how the money is being doled out. Can you set the table for us and let's explain why there really hasn't been real oversight into this process? Is that right?
So in essence, the City Council allocated to itself $6.5 million to give out to nonprofits and other for-profit organizations in their districts. So a few weeks ago, they distributed the first $1.9 million, and this is the second round. So there was some scrutiny about that first list. It was a list of nonprofits and for-profit organizations, and again, it was mostly handpicked by City Council members. So this round, it's $4.6 million, and there are 36 recipients, and so we went through that list and found at least a third of them either are directed by people that have donated to the council members' campaigns or the council member have worked with them in the past or have family members working with them. And there's a slew of other kinds of issues that Ray can talk about that we also...
Yeah. All of your reporting, by the way, people should check it out at WJCT.org. Raymond, what are some of the most, I guess, egregious examples that you found?
Well, a lot of them, it doesn't really seem like there was any sort of system for what amount of money was going to it. It just seemed like they were given a flat amount to give. So no matter how much an organization actually makes in a year or how much they've lost, because this is supposed to be COVID relief, it's supposed to be making up for lost revenues because of the pandemic, they're getting like $120,000, some of them $250,000. And based on their IRS tax filing, some of which haven't done so in over 10 years, some early as like 2007, they've posted revenues up to maybe $5,000 a year, and now they're getting a $120,000 check that supposedly is supposed to make up for revenue that they lost because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. We also have, you know, business ties. Jacoby Pittman, as CEO of the Claire White Mission, she was meeting with the CEO of River Region Human Services for potential partnerships between their two nonprofits, and now she's selected them to receive a $100,000 grant from this COVID relief money. And there's a bunch of instances like that where even if there's not direct donations, there's definitely business ties or people giving money to organizations that don't really seem to really need it in comparison. Hmm.
Lots of examples in your reporting. And let's be clear, the City Council Finance Chair Ron Salem, as you report, told his fellow council members in an email in August that they had 3 weeks to choose either one or two organizations to hand out. Each of them got to hand out over $240,000. That's really the only process, right, Claire?
And that's what council members told us, is that they had very little say in how it was allocated, except for that City Council was getting the $6.5 million. And then, according to what council members told us and the interchanges we saw via email, they were told by Sam Newby the first round that you have $100,000 to split four ways. And then this round, they were told you have $240,000 and you can either split it two ways or give it to one organization. So they could only give grants of $120,000 or $240,000. And it wasn't dependent on how much income or how much loss the organization had suffered.
It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment as our WJCT News investigation looks at the flawed process at City Hall for doling out millions in COVID relief money to local organizations. Raymond, you know, it's not to say that a lot of these organizations getting money aren't deserving. Mm-hmm. It's more that human nature being what it is, these council members gave the money to people they know, people they like, people they might have had a previous relationship with. There wasn't an independent process. And so a lot of other nonprofits that would have liked a chance at this money have been left out in the cold. That's the issue, isn't it?
Yeah. So there wasn't really any sort of public outreach that said, hey, we have this money. Send in your forms, compete with each other, and we'll dole out accordingly. It was basically just up to council members to reach out themselves. Michael Boylan, for instance, he said that when he received this email, he basically did all his own research. He reached out to some nonprofits and even a for-profit company that publishes a newsletter in his district that he decided to give half of his allocation to. And when I asked him, do you know if there was any vetting that you did? He basically said, you know, they filled out the single page form that had two questions on it. It looked good to me, so I decided to give them the money. Mm-hmm. And when I asked him if the city did any follow up to check their financials, he said no, there was no oversight.
So tonight, the city council will be meeting and deciding on how to hand out this money under the microscope of scrutiny, Claire, and criticism. A couple of council members have raised red flags. Matt Carlucci, who is running for mayor, has said we need to put a pause on this. Rory Diamond has proposed new guardrails for this kind of process. So tell us more about what they're both saying.
So the vote tonight is said to be an emergency vote. So they would pass it just on one reading. They discuss it and they would vote on whether or not to pass it tonight, where typically a bill would take three or four meetings of discussion, of second reading, going through the committee process. So what Councilman Carlucci is saying is that this should also be treated as other bills and go through the full process rather than having this emergency authorization. What some of the nonprofits we spoke to said is that we have only until September 22nd, 2022 to spend all these dollars. So it would make sense for it to be passed as an emergency. That's part of the justification for the emergency is that they have to spend it within the year due to the federal guidelines. Mm-hmm. But with very little oversight that went into the process in choosing the organizations, Councilman Carlucci, and I think many of the critics are saying there has to be a process at some point before we just hand out this money.
Do we know how other cities that are comparable to Jacksonville might have handled this similar kind of challenge? You know what I'm saying? I know that's not something you got into in your reporting, but I'm just curious. I think that's something that we might want to look at going forward. Other cities have tried or maybe not tried to put process around all of this federal money raining down on cities to try to lend some help. Let's go to some calls. It's our WJCT News investigation reporters Claire Heddles and Raymond Troncoso taking a deep dive into the controversy around how City Hall is doling out millions in COVID relief funds all over town. An investigation shows connections to council members made a big difference into who is getting the money. 549-2937. Hope in Riverside. Hello, Hope.
Hi, Melissa. I am so glad that you all have been doing this research. I was surprised when there wasn't more outrage in the community, but it does seem to be bubbling up at this point. As someone who has been on all sides of grant processes for nonprofits, both locally on the state level and nationally, it really is a slap in the face to all the nonprofit leaders in this community and those who help manage what are rigorous processes. If you look at public service grants or cultural council grants, even just here in Jacksonville, you know, those are grants where people are putting forward, you know, dozens of pages of information. They're doing quarterly and end of year reporting. It's a competitive process. It's database. And so for everyone who has to go through that every year to access city funding, to have this process now in place, which is a non-process, it really does
a non-process. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hope, thank you for that. Raymond, you know, she's right in that in the past, the way other grants have been handled, whether it's cultural council grants or others, there's an independent framework. There's a series of benchmarks so as to make sure that favoritism doesn't happen. That just hasn't been the case with this.
No, not at all. It really is just kind of giving council members basically infinite control over who they decide to give the money to. A lot of these organizations, some of them haven't posted, like I said before, haven't posted revenues above $5,000. Now they're getting $120,000. There didn't really seem to be any oversight to the process. They didn't have to submit any financial documents to prove anything. They just needed to write out a single statement that was satisfactory to a council member, but they didn't have to show them any evidence.
Mm-hmm. Jack in Intercoastal West. Hello, Jack. How are you?
Morning. Thanks for having me on today. I want to thank the team from WJCT for looking at this. This whole thing stinks. I think everyone knows that, and I'm happy to see some members of the council starting to raise objections to it, but it would have been nice to see these same objections be raised weeks ago when we were seeing the first, second, and third rounds of this money being doled out, because now we're several million out the door without any oversight, and, you know, especially the ones going to for-profit companies. This can't happen again because
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we lost you there for a sec, Jack. But thank you for your call. Okay. Claire Heddles, as he pointed out, this will be on the agenda tonight. Is there a chance the council will pull back, not give out this money, instead adopt legislation that's now been proposed to essentially police themselves? What can we expect?
I think the listener made a great point that it's been bubbling up and a lot of money has already been doled out. So it is sort of the very end of a process, that it's bubbled up to a point where I think it is likely to be debated and maybe hotly debated tonight. I'm not sure yet if we could predict what will happen, but
yeah, it's certainly become a matter of scrutiny. And Raymond, you know, as Claire said, four council members who run nonprofits already got money. Yep. The city council gave money to their colleagues with no oversight.
Unanimously,
for people that haven't followed this, let's explain the first chapter in this controversy. That was the opening shot. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, so there were basically four nonprofits ran by four council members that got funds. Three of those nonprofits actually didn't get COVID relief funds. They got funds from the city. And so we're talking about Rory Diamond's legislation. His legislation would actually only add oversight to those three nonprofits that got money from the city. In terms of COVID federal dollars, Rory Diamond's legislation, which probably won't even come up for vote until November after all this money's already been given out, wouldn't apply to these COVID grants that are going out. It's only regarding city funds. And yeah, those four nonprofits, including Reggie Gaffney's, which got $500,000 in COVID relief funds, were voted on unanimously by the council with very little questions asked at the meeting where they were given out.
Crystal tweets the show, "I run a nonprofit that distributes diapers to help families who struggle to afford this basic essential need. I would have loved the opportunity to compete for funding, but I was unaware of the process." 549-2937. Suzanne Jenkins is on the line, former city council member. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm calling because when I first went on the council in 99, our city council had something similar going on for rezonings and exceptions and variances, and you could get a special relief bill. But the only way you could get that is if you knew a council member and they filed a bill saying, oh, well, our laws don't apply to you when it comes to that, so we're going to let you do what you're asking. When I got there, I not only challenged the ability to do that, but the constitutionality of it.
And
it passed.
And it, okay.
I sent it over to the general counsel, which at the time was Rick Mullaney, asking for a legal opinion on this, a binding one. And he came back with, after he looked around the state to see what other cities and counties were doing, no one else had special relief. Because really what it meant was the only way you could get help is if you knew a council member and they agreed to do this for you, because there was no standards. So those were done away with. And this is very similar to that. And how this council and its legal counsel, the general counsel, allowed them to do this without cautioning them, saying, look, there's a real problem with this because you don't have any processes in place.
So you see this ultimately as a matter that the city's Office of General Counsel should be exercising more oversight into. Is that right?
Absolutely. Even if, and listen, I can tell you as a council member, we don't always ask for oversight because we don't want to know it. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't come to us when we're about to do something that could be a problematic and come and talk to us and say, hey, you know, we're looking this over and we have concerns here and we really think you either shouldn't do this or you change it so it will fit this way, because that's when the processes can come in place that makes it understandable and doable and legal.
Well, Suzanne, let me ask you then, as a follow-up, as someone who served on the city council, here we are right now in Jacksonville with this controversy over how these funds are being given out. We have trash piling up because curbside recycling has been put on pause. People are angry about that. There have been a number of issues that have angered the taxpayers, you know, the failed Lot J deal, for example. Taxpayers squawked about that loudly and it didn't go through. So how do you see this affecting not just this council, but the candidates that show up to run next time? How much of an issue do you think this will be that there's a real concern about the quality of our local governance?
I'm hoping that it will be the flashpoint we need to get candidates who will be accountable to the voters who are running and say, I'm not going to do this. I will always do that. I will never do this. And the thing about all and because as a candidate, I ran and people said, well, what about this? Will you ever? And here's the deal. I will do what's right with the information I have at the time we do the vote. Because once you learn something, if you've hemmed yourself into a corner saying, I will never do this or I only do that. But when you research it and you find other reasons why you should do it or shouldn't do it, you need to be open.
We're losing you, but thank you. That's Suzanne Jenkins. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Suzanne, thank you. I hate to cut you off, but the connection's not so great, but I really think we did get the gist of her thoughts. Claire, what about that? Interesting to get the insights from someone who used to serve.
Definitely. She made a lot of great points. And from the council members we talked to, a lot of them kind of made it seem like they were on an island with this decision, that they just received this email that said, you need to distribute the funds in this way. And then they just went out and found the organizations that they knew to give money to because they had to get rid of it within 3 weeks, basically.
Right. And so, Raymond, they've all kind of told the same story. So this isn't to indict individual council members. This is a systemic problem.
Yeah, it seems like overall it's just a flawed process. I talked to Brenda Priestley Jackson, councilwoman, who basically said that she doesn't see a conflict, even though that she had a personal relationship with one of her grantees, another one she had worked for previously as general counsel to the president of Edward Waters University, which she decided to give her money to. And she says she earnestly believes in the mission of both organizations, and she didn't see it as a conflict. But when you have a system where you're basically just giving council members, infinite choice of how they give out this money and how much to give out, it doesn't really seem like there's any real oversight to basically step in and be like, hey, maybe you shouldn't do that if you have a personal connection.
Peter on the South Side. Hello, Peter.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I can understand the righteous indignation, but I can see a case could be made where council members could distribute funds to not-for-profits in their district, as opposed to the larger, well-heeled, well-known organizations that have full-time people working on grant requests, et cetera, et cetera. So I would see this as a good vehicle for the smaller organizations within someone's district, not as well known as the major ones that that have a high profile.
Thanks for that, Peter. Let's get to a few more calls. Eric in Arlington. Hello, Eric. Thanks for holding.
Hey, Melissa. I just tuned in. I'm assuming that this is federal money.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So here's I guess, my gripe. We hear over and over again all the time in the media, at the newsstand, wherever, conversations amongst coworkers, the water cooler, that the federal government can't do anything right. And whenever possible, we should always defer to the locals. We should have state control. We should have county control, because people locally know the best what to do. Well, here we have a situation where the federal government did their part. They handed it off to Jacksonville. And what did Jacksonville do? The same good old boy stuff that has kept this city in the situation it's in for as long as I've lived here, going on more than maybe 50 years. Thanks for taking my call.
Eric, thanks. Claire, this does play into a long-running narrative in Jacksonville that despite the fact that the city is big, growing, becoming more diverse, becoming a really... a modern 21st century city, that there's still this old school, good old boy way of doing things that's a hangover from the last century, that it's holding this city back. And this whole flap is yet another example of that. That is certainly a strong perception.
And a few of the council members that I talked to said that this is totally unprecedented to have this much federal money, and so they sort of had to do things in an unprecedented way. But I think as we hear from listeners and knowing the history of Jacksonville, there's a lot of things about this process that aren't unprecedented. There actually is a precedent for taking some liberties, it sounds like, for council.
Here's an email from Ann Raymond. Why not go back to the list of applicants for the public service grants and award funds to those who did not win money during that process? You could even increase the amount some winners won to fully fund their request. This would add boundaries to the process that were needed in the first place.
Yeah, so that's kind of something that Carlucci is trying to do at tonight's meeting. He wants to ask them to basically scrap this emergency bill and start over, come up with a new process that maybe has some more oversight, and maybe will allow for more nonprofits. A previous listener talked about, you know, this was a chance for some smaller nonprofits that don't normally get money to receive some. And that's true. A lot of those small nonprofits were actually chosen for this. It's just the amount of money that they're given, this flat amount for $120,000, is way more than those little organizations see, not just in a year, but in a whole decade. And this is supposed to be making up for lost revenues. So if they were able to maybe split those dollar amounts into smaller packages to give some money to these smaller organizations, it might be a better system than just dumping $120,000 on an organization of four people in some cases that tailors, you know, suits for kids in Northside or runs a track and field, as Reggie Gaffney's chosen organization is, which runs a club of maybe like 30 kids, and they're getting a $120,000 grant. So it's stuff like that.
Megan tweets the show, they shouldn't be allowed to give money to organizations they're associated with. That is called conflict of interest. Nancy on the line in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Nancy. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Last week you had Ben Frazier on your program, and I have absolutely no relationship with him, nor do I know him, but every time I hear him speak, I think this is a man who does his homework and knows what he's talking about. One of your callers called in and said that he thought that Ben Frazier should run for city council, and it was dismissed by Mr. Frazier. I agree with your caller. I think that he should run for city council because not only these federal grants have to be looked at more closely, but city contracts have to be looked at more closely. And the division of any kind of city monies. I applied for two of the grants under the CARES Act and did not receive either one of them. Okay, that's fine. But one of the reasons I didn't receive one of the grants was that my bank would not accept the terms. Well, it seems to me that that should have been worked out ahead of time. And I believe with someone like Mr. Frazier in there looking at things more carefully, that might be taken care of.
All right, Nancy. And I don't believe he has any intention of running for office. I'm sure he appreciates your comments. But that said, Claire, potential new candidates, they now have some issues to run on, don't they?
That is very true. That is very true. And one other thing we found as we were looking at this is that there was very little coordination between the council members. Some of them chose the same nonprofit. And when we talked to the nonprofits, they said they weren't aware of any coordination. So,
and to be fair to them, they are limited in how they can talk to each other due to Sunshine Law. So I do want to add that into the discussion. All of that said, though, excellent reporting. Go to WJCT.org so you can learn a lot more about how your council member plan to give out these relief dollars. We will follow the action tonight at the meeting. Things could change tomorrow. In the meantime, great work, Claire Heddles, Raymond Troncoso. Again, their investigation live now at WJCT.org. And thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks, Melissa.
And much more still ahead later. How you can celebrate the written word this weekend. It's at the Jax by Jax Literary Arts Festival. And up next.
And we did a chapter a day, just talking over the phone. And then when she was finished, we had a rough draft of a book.
Author Jane Condon on how she built two powerhouse schools in Jacksonville, La Villa and Douglas Anderson. We'll be right back.
Thank you. That was great.
It's a story of love, dedication, and education. Chosen by Jane is a new memoir of the highly successful principal of two Jacksonville arts magnet schools. When she first took over the failing at the time Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, Jane Condon quickly turned the program around and brought it to national stature with award-winning performers and successful alumni practicing their arts all over the world. She was then tapped to build a magnet middle school of the arts. Jane designed the facility and developed the faculty, staff, and arts and academic programs that would become the La Villa School of the Arts. Both schools continue to thrive and are considered cultural treasures in this city. In Chosen by Jane, she tells this story as she develops into a leader whose vision remains clear through both personal and bureaucratic challenges. And Jane has thoughts about the challenges educators now have in this current pandemic. I spoke with Jane Condon about her new memoir. It's co-authored with Carol Grimes and Susan Brandenburg. And here's that conversation. Jane Condon, it's so good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, it's good to talk to you as well.
You know, I think this is perfect timing on your part. You and your co-author, Carol Grimes, coming out with a book about your life in Jacksonville and your career as principal at Douglas Anderson and La Villa. Certainly, as DA is searching for a new principal, whoever gets picked needs to pick up your book as their first order of business. So
we'll try to make that happen.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So tell me about the book and what inspired it.
The fact that we were in a pandemic and we're supposed to stay home. And so a person came to me and asked me if I would consider doing one. And I said, I guess so. I need to stay home. So Susan Brandenburg and I, she called me every day and we did a chapter a day just talking over the phone. And then when she was finished, we had a rough draft of a book. So Carol then picked it up at that point, and Carol and I kind of rounded it out and added other things I'd forgotten and made it into a final version.
For people that are familiar with you, they know about your incredible leadership at Douglas Anderson and also LaVella, and how you've sent students on to the best universities in the world, like Juilliard, the Parsons School of Design, and so on and so on. And also how you navigated what can often be a really difficult academic environment for educators. So you have a lot of wisdom to share for the challenges schools are currently facing. What do you see as some of the biggest challenges, and what are some of your insights?
Well, I think some of the biggest challenges are that there is a movement almost that what's good for one is good for all. And I don't agree with that at all. I had my own guidelines at the time I was there, at least at Douglas Anderson. I decided, you know, I think I know better than somebody else what's good for this school. And all schools are not alike. And so I began to do things that, and it's in the book, do things that were my own idea of how it should be. And when it worked, no one was unhappy about it. So it's one of those things, you know, you have to look within the structure and make choices that work for the school and the families and the students that you have in that particular school. And I'm really opposed to what's good for one is good for all.
Well, that certainly has been the rallying cry of school districts around the state in this pandemic who have suffered under, I think it's fair to say, top-down leadership from the state offering
yes.
blanket policies on how to keep children and staff safe in the pandemic. In our area, Duval County has flouted the state's orders to try to reduce the spread of COVID-19. So what's your advice to school officials? They are dealing with this kind of climate.
I think it is to go ahead and do what you know is right and take the consequences. I think it's for us to give in. If we're in a position of authority, then we need to decide what is best for the families and the students that I'm responsible for and do it that way. I remember saying once to an auditor, well, look, stop telling me what I can't do. Help me figure out how I can do it. And that sort of took the breath away from him, and he helped me.
Hmm. Yeah. So then being a principal as you are or a teacher, it requires real bravery at this stage in our history, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think it requires good judgment, too. I'm not suggesting that someone become, just very difficult to deal with. I think you do it as quietly and as progressively as possible without making a big deal, because the last thing an administrator wants is to get in a bad way with whoever it is who's over them in a position. I think if you can do it in a way that makes the families and the students happy and makes them feel that what's happening has them foremost in your mind, they're very likely to take your approach and use it positively within the school system. That's what I found.
There is a new principal at Douglas Anderson now, by the way. Tina Wilson was just tapped for the post. And you can buy the new memoir, Chosen by Jane, wherever books are sold. Check out her website, chosenbyjane.com. Well, speaking of books, here's another suggestion for you. It's not your typical Ernest Hemingway story, but our book club leader, Stacey Goldring, says Garden of Eden is a timeless tale that's actually relevant to the culture wars of today. It's our pick for this month's book club. Stacey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Good to hear your voice. You know, when I think of Hemingway, I think of The Sun Also Rises, The Old Man and the Sea, not Garden of Eden. What attracted you to this book?
This book was suggested by, again, members of our book club, and it definitely is not your typical Hemingway. Melissa, when we think of Hemingway, like you said, we have a certain macho image. We think bullfighting, war reporting, expat, you know, a real marlin fishing, drinking at Sloppy Joe's, you know, this he is the uber masculine figure, and his protagonist in his books usually are too, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, there is a deeper side to Hemingway, and this book, The Garden of Eden, is actually two stories. It is the story of a young couple who is honeymooning in an Edenic, Garden of Eden, Edenic environment. They're in the French Riviera, enjoying their beautiful honeymoon together. And the new wife, Catherine, announces she has a surprise. And I don't know about you, Melissa, but I don't like surprises. And Catherine reveals to her new husband, David, that she has a surprise for him, and he'll just have to wait, but it's going to be a big change. And he's going to like it, and she is too. She comes back a day later, and she has a very short haircut. What ensues after that is a story of a young writer who is struggling to write his second good book. He had just published one that was successful, his first one. And he's dealing with a wife who is exploring her gender identity.
Gender identity. You know, Stacey,
yeah.
I watched the PBS series on Hemingway that aired recently here on Jack's PBS television.
Yeah.
And what I didn't know about Hemingway that I learned watching this series was that he struggled with his identity, his gender identity all his life, actually, because when he was a little kid, a baby and a young child, his mother dressed him up like a girl.
As a sister. Yeah.
Dressed him to match his sister. That launched him on a whole life of this really performative masculinity, this macho public identity. But what we learned watching this program was that in his private life, he and his various wives would play with gender roles. People don't know that about Hemingway, but we learned that.
Okay, let's back up a minute. First of all, a theme of this book could be hashtag blame the mother, right?
Yeah,
you know that,
right? Yeah.
Okay, so let's just reel it in a bit. All right, so we have that, right? We have him as a young child being dressed like a little girl or as a little boy, whatever it was twinning, it was matching the sister. When you look at his four wives, three of them having very short hair, just like his, both dyeing their hair, both playing with these roles in the bedroom. We also see an eternal conflict because, you know, the book was never meant to be a book. And this is the second story, Melissa. This is a book that was started in 1946. He worked on it for 15 years, and then he committed suicide. Okay. It was in three different manuscripts that had to be cobbled together by scriveners. And we'll be discussing the book, by the way, 11 o'clock today, chapterandlens.com, if you want to join the discussion. So we're dealing with a story that the author never meant for anyone to know about. And when we think about people coming, quote unquote, out of the closet or coming out, that usually, hopefully, God willing, is a choice. We do not give Hemingway that choice. When Scribner's decided to publish this, it was in 1986, think about who you were in 1986, right? We are, you know, greed is good. We're in the middle of an HIV/AIDS crisis. And sex sells, Melissa. So this book is published then.
We've come a long way on these discussions since the 80s in terms of the LGBT community. And by the way, National Coming Out Day was this week. So this is an especially timely discussion for you to have, right?
Yeah, it really is. And he was how he treats this issue of gender fluidity is he was really ahead of his time, struggling with it because there was no vocabulary for it back then. You know? There really wasn't.
And, of course, Hemingway suffered from depression and did die by suicide. And how much of this confusion that he had over gender, how much that contributed to his depression, I guess it's impossible to know.
We'll never know. So we come to this book, Melissa, as a gift and something we have to treat with great respect because we call it a book. But he never gave that permission. However, we now get to see a writer with greater depth. Now you have the opportunity to or not to look back at the rest of his works and examine those characters and the relationship, the machismo, the relationships he had with the other female characters in his book, and you have the opportunity, if you did or did not like Hemingway, to read these books again through a completely different lens. And that's what Garden of Eden really is all about. You know, what is the story of the Garden of Eden? It's about a knowledge, you know, Eve, again, the female being the blamed individual, taking a bite from the apple, you know, from the tree of knowledge. And once you know something about someone or you know something about yourself, it is a loss of innocence. And then you have to decide what you're going to do with that. And it also can actually be a third book. You can choose to read it through the lens of a writer. And you're a writer. You write every day as you create the show. And so you can look at it as through someone who is so dedicated to his craft and what you go through in your personal life in order to perform in order to create this document that you plan on sharing with the world. It's a very complicated, it's a really complicated book. And I believe talking about it with others in a book group is a great way to learn more about these issues.
And I encourage everyone to join Stacy's book club today. It's online at 11 a.m. As they get into The Garden of Eden by Ernest Hemingway, go to chapterendnotes.com and sign up and have fun. Always good to hear your voice. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And in a moment, we continue our Festival of the Written Word, a preview of this weekend's Jax by Jax Literary Arts Bash. That's coming up in just a minute. Keep it right here. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be right back.
Mayo Clinic. If you're looking for answers no one else has been able to find, and it's time to get some certainty once and for all, you know where to go. Mayo Clinic. More at mayoclinic.org/Florida. Lee & Kate's Glass. Family owned and operated for 95 years. Lee & Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com.
The Jacksonville Symphony's spectacular fall season continues with performances of Bach's lively Brandenburg Concerto No. 1, performed for you in Jacoby Symphony Hall, October 22nd and 23rd. Treat yourself to a sensational evening of live classical music, a night out to be shared with family and friends. Tickets and information at jacksymphony.org.
The Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT Public Media is your ticket to the local scene. Music reviews, curated playlists, music history, concert recommendations, profiles of local artists, and more. Turn your ear on the beautiful noise emerging from Northeast Florida and learn more about the local artist whose music is reverberating across the country. Visit jacksmusic.org to play it local and play it loud.
All of the three villains in the new Bond movie have nasty plans to do away with 007. But there's something else they have in common. All have facial disfigurements. Hollywood has long used facial differences to indicate evil, but activists have had enough. We'll hear from a community that's urging filmmakers and us to look at them differently. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the 8th annual Jacks by Jacks Literary Arts Festival is back this weekend. Jacks by Jacks is a celebration of writers, and there's a packed agenda for both Friday and Saturday. Lots to do, see, and learn. I got a preview when I spoke the other day with festival organizer Brad Kuhn. Take a listen.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for joining us. It's exciting to talk about Jacks by Jacks being back again. Tell us what's happening this year.
Well, thank you for having us on again, Melissa. We are really excited this year. I know that some of your listeners may know that last year we had to go virtual, which I think we did the best we could, but we really wanted to come back with a vengeance in 2021, and I think we've succeeded. We've teamed up with Shawana Brooks and her Moving the Margins program, which is part of the Jacksonville Cultural Development Corporation, and the Literacy Alliance of Northeast Florida, headed by Marcus Hale, to really come up with something we think is wonderful. On for the first time, we're going to have a Friday night program, and that's going to be a play, actually a dramatic presentation, dramatic reading of Repossessions, Mass Shooting at Bay Meadows, that a play based on the book by Tim Gilmore, who founded Jacks by Jacks several years ago, 8 years ago. That's going to be directed by Barbara Colicello of Babs Lab.
That's excellent. So you've got the leading literary and cultural lights of the city coming to this with the themes of gun violence and civic engagement. The readings, yes, most of them relate to those topics. So tell us more about that.
That's really a function of Moving the Margins. That was something that Shawana Brooks and our partnership with the Jacksonville Cultural Development Corporation brought to the table this year.
That's obviously a problem for the nation, but gun violence is a big problem in Jacksonville. We have been the murder capital of Florida off and on for two decades now. So how do you see a literary festival impacting this problem, which just continues to be a scourge for this city?
Sure. Well, Melissa, as you are aware, histories are written by the winners of wars, traditionally. But the actual histories are recorded contemporaneously by the poets and the writers and the artists of the day. And we have really, starting last year, but especially this year, tried to make Jacks by Jacks that that place where we get these voices together and really do our best to chronicle and record these upwellings and thoughts of the times we're in.
And so people, as you said, can attend in person this year. It was virtual last year. But this October, people can come out to the Jesse Ball DuPont Center downtown on Adams Street, which is always a beautiful place to visit, and be part of this. Tell us how everyone can join in.
Well, that's correct. This is a free event, as always. We want as many people to come out and experience literature as possible. We want people to recognize that literature is not just words on a page, but it's really a contact sport. And so they can come out at 7:30 on Friday night, which is when Tim's presentation is going to be in the lobby of the Jesse Ball DuPont Center. And then the next morning at 10 a.m., we begin with 8 writers at 10 a.m. up both on the rooftop garden and in the auditorium. And then we will have readings from 12:30 to 2:30 by students from not only our usual suspects at the Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, FSCJ, UNF, but also we're going to have a student this year from the Literary Alliance of Northeast Florida, somebody who has recently learned to read, taught them through the help of the Alliance, and is actually trying to publish a children's book. So we're very excited to have this student with us.
And there's so much more on the agenda that we didn't even get into. You can just go to their website, folks. That's jacksbyjacks.com for the Jacks by Jacks Literary Art Festival, Friday, October 15th and Saturday, October 16th. At the Jesse Ball DuPont Center on Adams Street downtown, with the new presenting sponsor, Moving the Margins, a program of the Jacksonville Cultural Development Corporation. Check it out, everyone. Brad Kuhn, Jacks by Jacks, good to talk to you. I'm so glad it's going ahead this year, and let's celebrate reading and literature. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Have fun, everyone, and let us know what you're reading this month. Because we do have a book club here on the show, as we heard earlier in the hour, drop us a line with your favorite books and what you'd like to see us talk about on the next book club. Send those emails to bookclub@wjct.org. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks also to senior producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, associate producer Catherine Hobbs, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and news editor Randy Roguski, and the entire WJCT News team. Here's another email. We love your feedback. Drop us a line at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And catch our podcast up later today. Like and subscribe on all platforms. You can also always listen through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day. Be safe, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.